Welcome back to Cases from the Community, where we're going to be integrating new research findings into clinical oncology practice. So this is, again, a multi-tumor symposium in partnership with American Oncology Network. This is going to be Module 3. Dr. O is kind enough to be here with us today. Dr. O is Associate Professor of Medicine and Chief Division of Hematology at WashU in St. Louis, Missouri. So welcome. Thank you for being here. These are Dr. O's disclosures and mine. And just a reminder, we do pull data from the network using the data platform MEBA to provide some context for patients within the network on various treatments. We're going to be discussing ruxolitinib, momelotinib, pacritinib, and fedratinib today. So here are the numbers within the network of patients on those therapies. We're also going to be showing individual cases from our physicians within the network to, you know, highlight key study findings, but also to pose questions to our faculty experts here today. So we'll go ahead and get started with a case from Dr. Warsh.
The next case is presented by Dr. Warsh.
This is a 75-year-old male, overall very healthy. He had a persistent anemia, sort of ranging from 8 to 9, normal white cell, normal platelets, and this bone marrow showed moderate degrees of myelofibrosis, no blasts, but features of MDS as well as MPN, as well as two JAK mutations, an SF3B1 mutation, as well as ring sideroblasts. How would we classify this person? Does she have MDS? Does she have MPN? Based off of the new data with luspatercept, we thought that really to palliate his anemia, given the lack of other symptoms, he's done remarkably well, and then his hemoglobins have been right around 11.
Okay, great question. And I think we're seeing this more and more, particularly in the NGS space where you have multiple mutations and sort of how do we think about those? Particularly in the classification of MDS relative to MPN, given them both mutations listed there. So what are your thoughts on that from a diagnostic standpoint or classification, but also from a therapeutic?
Yeah, so we're kind of jumping right into a pretty interesting and complicated case here. So for sure, you know, we see that in patients with MPN or MDS-MPN, somewhat frequently, of course, JAK2 mutation, but SF3B1 mutation as well is a recurrent mutation, whether it's myelofibrosis or MDS-MPN. And one just sort of, I think, fascinating aspect of that is that those patients that have SF3B1 mutation, they may or may not have ring sideroblasts. This patient here, as described with ring sideroblasts in that setting, I think would most likely fall into that MDS-MPN with ring sideroblasts and plus or minus thrombocytosis. I think the case was presented as having a normal platelet count. But I think, you know, regardless of how we classify this patient, many roads in this kind of particular case point towards luspatercept. We know it has activity in the MDS setting, in particular in patients with ring sideroblasts. There is emerging data in patients with myelofibrosis that luspatercept has efficacy for anemia. So again, I think for multiple angles in a case like this, the obvious choice for treatment would be luspatercept.
All right. Just to load your plate with difficult questions right out of the gate. And then, you know, we pose these questions to create a frame of reference. And then, you know, Dr. O goes through the data to educate us here. So next case is Dr. Mulhern with some comments by Dr. Boucher.
The next case is presented by Dr. Mulhern with follow-up questions from Dr. Boucher. 74-year-old man.
He has myelofibrosis, and I will say he is not an allogeneic stem cell transplant candidate and put that there. So he has 4 months of this worsening fatigue, satiety, night sweats, fevers, etc. He's got a pretty big spleen, and he's got a JAK2 V617F mutation, ASXL1. So what's the best treatment for this patient? So his hemoglobin is 10.4. He's kind of more this kind of proliferative side. He's not this kind of cytopenic, you know, subtype. I put him on ruxolitinib. What happens if his hemoglobin was 8? What do you think about using frontline momelotinib? I guess one other thing I'd ask for the faculty, how often would you radiographically assess their spleen? If you don't think they're progressing, would you do an ultrasound? You just go by palpation?
We now have 4 approved drugs for myelofibrosis. How do you select which drug to use? Is your selection different now because of ACVR1 and the decrease in the anemia-producing properties that pacritinib and momelotinib have compared to ruxolitinib. Should we still continue to use ruxolitinib? Do you ever use fedratinib? And if you do, do you ever use it frontline or do you save it for rux failures? I think relapsed myelofibrosis is still a big problem. If you have a patient on ruxolitinib and they fail, outside of a clinical trial, what would you do with that patient today? Do you use much in the way of danazol for the anemia? How do you manage these patients as they become more fibrotic and more anemic?
So that's a lot to unpack. I think, you know, maybe let's get into the data and then we can circle back to these questions, maybe a little more helpful, but defer to your thoughts.
No, absolutely. So as we go through the presentation, I'll touch on all of the points and questions that were raised here. But increasingly, you know, on the one hand, we have more options with four approved treatments, but as outlined, this remains difficult. And in many patients, we have to think carefully about what is the best option and when. Okay, so I'll take you through an overview of the four FDA-approved JAK inhibitors that we have at our disposal currently. And as shown on this slide, those four drugs are ruxolitinib, fedratinib, pacritinib, and momelotinib. And these are all JAK inhibitors, so they share in common the ability to target JAK2, but they're, as a class, referred to as JAK inhibitors because, to differing extents, they tend to have at least some activity against other JAK kinases, such as JAK1. Now, these nuances do have some distinction with regard to both efficacy and side effects with these different compounds, but you can see here, as nicely outlined, the timing of when these drugs are approved. So ruxolitinib now more than a decade ago, fedratinib in 2019, pacritinib and momelotinib more recently. And I'll take you through in more detail with the upcoming slides, but some of the specific side effects that we may encounter with these particular treatments. Okay, so very briefly, I'm sure now that the drug has been approved for over a decade, and as the survey showed, many of you have experience with ruxolitinib. I won't go into too much detail, but the two phase three studies that led to the original approval of ruxolitinib in myelofibrosis were the COMFORT 1 and COMFORT 2 studies. In COMFORT 1, patients were randomized to treatment with either ruxolitinib or placebo, and in COMFORT 2, ruxolitinib versus best available therapy. A couple of points to keep in mind here with this data. One is that all patients had to have a baseline platelet count of at least 100,000. In terms of efficacy, the spleen volume response, 35% reduction in spleen volume, which has become the sort of standard metric as a primary endpoint for these drugs, was in the range of around 30-40% across these two studies, and has, I think, in the real world setting, held up as what we should expect. Now, symptoms as this either the key primary secondary endpoint, or co-primary endpoint, the total symptom score we see here with COMFORT 1, 46% met that endpoint. And again, this is something I think in the real world we probably have all experienced, that ruxolitinib tends to be very helpful for a symptom benefit. Now, I think many of us have counseled patients to emphasize those benefits, spleen size reduction and the symptom improvement that's related to that, as well as overall symptom improvement as being the primary benefits of ruxolitinib. For that reason alone, it's a very useful treatment. But the question remains as to whether ruxolitinib or any of these drugs have a more meaningful or longer-term benefit. There has been some survival data with ruxolitinib, as shown here, the COMFORT 1 and COMFORT 2 studies with pooled survival analysis. This kind of thing is a little bit fraught statistically when you have a crossover in these studies, and that can be corrected for to a certain extent based on the statistical analysis, but remains a little bit complicated. Now, with that said, in this analysis, it did indicate that there is at least a modest improvement in survival with ruxolitinib, and so this further reinforces the long-term benefit of treatment with ruxolitinib. Okay, so switching gears to fedratinib. So this was the second JAK inhibitor approved, and this went through a little bit of a tortuous path to eventually leading to approval. But just to summarize, this drug was approved on the basis of the Jakarta studies, and you can see the key characteristics of the Jakarta and Jakarta 2 studies in either previously untreated myelofibrosis patients or those who had been pre-treated with ruxolitinib. And I think the key point here with fedratinib in this data is that in the Jakarta 2 study in patients who had previously been treated with ruxolitinib, there was a pretty impressive response rate in terms of spleen and symptom response in that post-ruxolitinib setting, to suggest that the use of fedratinib really could be relevant, particularly in that setting. Now, following the initial results that were published from that study, there was some question about, well, how stringent really were those patients in terms of considering them ruxolitinib refractory or post-ruxolitinib failures? And so there was post-hoc analysis to make this a little bit more stringent, as shown in green, and defining those patients a little bit more, again, more stringently, requiring at least 3 months of ruxolitinib treatment or showing clear increase in spleen size or developing refractoriness in terms of cytopenias and things like that. With that in mind, the reanalysis of the study showed that although the response rates were not necessarily quite as robust, they still were pretty decent. And so this does, again, reinforce that fedratinib could be a good option in that post-ruxolitinib setting. Okay, so just continuing our quick tour here of the JAK inhibitor, so pactinib. So pac== is a JAK inhibitor that is a little bit distinct compared to some of the other JAK inhibitors, in particular, as it seems to be particularly useful in patients with severe thrombocytopenia. And this was based primarily on the PERSIST-2 study. So as shown here, patients were eligible specifically with a baseline platelet count of less than or equal to 100,000. As I pointed out with the COMFORT studies, patients had to have at least a platelet count of 100,000. So targeting those patients who are particularly difficult to treat with the low platelet counts, here activity with pacritinib was clearly demonstrated. Not a super high response rate as shown on the bottom in terms of spleen and symptom response, but these are patients for whom we really don't have good options otherwise. And so at the least, in those patients with severe thrombocytopenia, probably have been previously treated with ruxolitinib plus or minus one or more other JAK inhibitors, this is really the option that remains. Now, what has been sort of subsequently identified with pacritinib, and what has also been delineated with momelotinib, as I will get into in just a minute, is that pacritinib also seems to have some capacity to improve anemia. And this is shown on the right of the slide with post-hoc analysis from the PERSIST-2 study, demonstrating that there, in fact, are patients who are able to achieve transfusion independence and or have at least some degree of anemia benefit. And we know mechanistically, sort of going back after the fact, after these studies were conducted from the clinical trials, that it turns out that pacritinib has activity against ACVR1. And ACVR1 is the primary regulator of hepcidin production. And we know that targeting hepcidin seems to have benefit with regard to anemia. And this is something that we also know about momelotinib. So it all kind of fits together that there is, in fact, some capacity to improve anemia with pacritinib that is shared between pacritinib and momelotinib and is distinct from fedratinib and ruxolitinib, neither of which have inhibitory activity against ACVR1 and neither of which we would expect improvement in anemia. So that's a nice segue into momelotinib. So momelotinib was the most recently approved JAK inhibitor. This also went through a bit of a tortuous path before it was ultimately FDA approved. But this was on the basis of multiple phase 3 studies. So you have the SIMPLIFY-1 and SIMPLIFY-2 studies. And then finally, the MOMENTUM study, which is really what got it across the finish line. And just to focus on that primarily, so in the MOMENTUM study, patients were randomized to treatment with either momelotinib or danazol. And this was precisely to focus on the benefits of momelotinib as a JAK inhibitor, but also to be able to compare it against something that might have the ability to also improve anemia. And so with that in mind, not surprisingly, momelotinib was superior in terms of the more traditional endpoints of spleen and symptom response, and then also demonstrated capacity to improve anemia. And that is shown here as well. So again, you wouldn't necessarily expect danazol to specifically have activity in terms of spleen response, plus or minus symptom response, and that clearly was demonstrated to be superior with momelotinib. And then both drugs did show capacity to improve anemia, as indicated by transfusion independence, and suggesting that momelotinib was at least as good or better than danazol.
Okay, a couple of questions for you. It's a lot to unpack. I said we'd circle back to that, but with respect to classification of these disease states from a MDS to an MPN to myelofibrosis, I mean, you know, because sometimes the treatment paths are different. There may be some overlap with luspatercept, et cetera. But so with respect to the JAK inhibitors, what are you seeing on a pathology report, whatever, that's where you say, hey, these are going to be my go-to here, and then how do you select which one and the sequence there, just in practice in general?
Sure, absolutely. So in terms of diagnosis, it can be a little bit nuanced. You know, we can see some degree of fibrosis in patients with myelodysplastic syndrome. So just because there's some fibrosis does not mean a patient has myelofibrosis per se. And on the flip side, in patients with myelofibrosis, there can be some dysplasia as well, primarily in the megakaryocyte lineage. So if it's mostly megakaryocytic atypia, that would fit more with myelofibrosis. So I think it's important for that to be teased out and you know, not to sort of, you know, just look at the bone marrow report and see dysplasia and say that's myelodysplastic syndrome. That's a key point. We also think, you know, increasingly with all heme malignancies, of course, that the mutations guide us in terms of diagnosis. That's true. But as the first case outlined, JAK2 mutation, SF3B1 mutation, that doesn't tell us necessarily for sure what the specific diagnosis is. So we have to add the histopathological interpretation into the context of the mutations. Ideally, some molecular testing at the minimum for MPNs, JAK2, and if that's negative, CALR, and if that's negative, MPL, plus or minus a more extended myeloid sequencing panel to look for other mutations. Now, in terms of you know, the choice of treatment, with the four JAK inhibitors, they're not specific to mutant JAK2, so they can be used in patients with JAK2, CALR, MPL mutation. It's mutation agnostic in that sense. We are beginning to understand that there are specific subsets of patients with myelofibrosis that are a little bit distinct. They're not black and white, but as I think mentioned with the first case or the second case, more proliferative types of myelofibrosis where the counts tend to be relatively preserved. And then this term of cytopenic myelofibrosis, where the cytopenias tend to be more severe, often in that sort of severe thrombocytopenia, more significant anemia setting. And that does guide us a little bit in terms of the choice of treatment. And in particular, as I mentioned, with pacritinib and momelotinib, pacritinib in particular with severe thrombocytopenia, and momelotinib in the setting of anemia.
So, you know, taking that into account, if you saw a patient, you know, with thrombocytopenia, where would pacritinib fit, you know, if you had a patient? At least in my mind, you know, you're seeing somebody, you put them on, you know, a JAK2 inhibitor, you typically see worsening of the cytopenias, anemia goes down, and you go, hey, maybe we switched to momelotinib here, et cetera. But, you know, like, how would you sequence that? Would you ever go straight to one of those if the counts are really low, like if they're not a candidate for, mm-hmm. you know, the COMFORT trials, ruxolitinib, you have 100,000?
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's some black box warnings hidden in there in some mm-hmm. of these guys. Can you touch on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the most logical, you know, sort of way to think about this is if the platelet count is above 100,000, as in the COMFORT studies, ruxolitinib remains a really good choice. And in particular, if spleen and symptoms are bothersome, that is where we think of ruxolitinib as being sort of the standard of care, the best choice. You know, I look at this as it's a, you know, we have to take the case as a whole. It's the counts, it's the symptoms, it's the spleen. So again, if the spleen is gigantic, the symptoms are quite severe, I continue to favor ruxolitinib if the counts can withstand that. If the more prominent issue is anemia, let's say the baseline hemoglobin is already below 10, maybe their patient's approaching transfusion and dependence, then you can certainly make a case for considering momelotinib. Maybe even as a frontline choice. More commonly, we'll start with ruxolitinib and then at some point consider moving to momelotinib because inevitably the anemia is probably going to get worse anyway. So that's a common scenario. Start with the ruxolitinib, move to momelotinib at some point, particularly if the anemia gets worse. And with pacritinib, if the baseline platelet count is very low, you know, defined as for sure less than 50,000, I think pacritinib is makes sense, again, whether it's first line or beyond. But again, inevitably with these patients, we tend to see that the cytopenias are going to worsen over time. So we may be cycling through one, two, or three of these different JAK inhibitors.
Okay, this is a question that came in, but you know, now for hypercoagulable workups, we sometimes check JAK2, and so sometimes you stumble upon something in a patient who may be completely asymptomatic, right? I mean, your initial trials were looking at total symptom score and splenomegaly. So what do we do with these folks who, you know, do have an obvious, you know, JAK-STAT pathway mutation, maybe have, minimal symptoms and maybe minimal findings in the marrow. And I sort of gauge in that question with, when the new patient comes in, what do we tell them the advantages of these targeted therapies are, and how are they going to change their expected survival and outcomes?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, of course, as I kind of ran through historically, we've thought of the JAK inhibitors as their primary benefit being for symptom relief. And so if a patient has minimal symptoms, then, certainly you can question, is there any real rationale to intervene if that's not the case? Now, you can think about ruxolitinib and the survival data I showed, and maybe think of it as earlier the better in terms of achieving some degree of benefit over the long term. But I think that's still remains a little bit fuzzy. It does, I think, bring to bear the question that I think as a field we're increasingly really trying to tackle, which is, can we and should we and shouldn't we be moving to different endpoints, different goals, survival, progression-free survival, things like that, with the novel agents that we're beginning to investigate, so that we can, we'd love to provide symptom benefit, but really have those as the primary goal.
Yeah, it's been a tough task when the disease state, you'd have to run a trial for an enormous length of time, right, for the natural history of the disease. Particular side effects that, we've had, I know I had a patient we discussed, momelotinib, and he immediately Googled and found the package insert and came back and was like, there's no way I'm taking this.
Absolutely. So just to comment on that briefly. So I kind of briefly comment us with all four of these JAK inhibitors. So with ruxolitinib, the primary side effect really is the cytopenias. It's going to lower the platelet count. It's going to lower the hemoglobin. We have always said with ruxolitinib, we'll take that in terms of a worsening of anemia because it provides such good symptom relief overall. So patients will often say they feel better even if their hemoglobin is dropped. Outside of that, we do see some association with infection with ruxolitinibs, and that's something that can range from the sort of 1 in a million rare serious infections. It can range from herpes reactivation, but it's definitely something that is specific to ruxolitinib. There's also an association with non-melanoma skin cancer with ruxolitinib that can become problematic for some patients. And then finally, weight gain is very common with ruxolitinib. That is not necessarily so much of a problem if you've got your most severe myelofibrosis patient who happens to have 30 pounds of weight loss before they begin treatment. But as we began to treat patients earlier, that where they haven't had significant weight loss, that sometimes becomes limiting. With fedratinib, it does come with some GI toxicity, and that can be limiting to a certain extent. There is a black box warning for a Wernicke's or Wernicke's-like encephalopathy. That is probably a rare complication, if that. It's been questioned as to some of the cases that were reported as to whether they really met the criteria to call that Wernicke's encephalopathy. But that is certainly something that's of concern with fedratinib. With pactinib, it also does cause some GI toxicity. So these are things where if you're going to start something like pacківtinib, you might consider recommending that a patient take antiemetics up front when they first start. This tends to get better over time. So start with the sort of upfront prophylaxis and then peel it off if the patient's tolerating it just fine. And then just counsel them to be prepared for the possibility of diarrhea. And just set expectations so that they're realistic in that sense. With momelotinib, there's a little bit milder GI toxicity, but the other thing as well that I think since the drug has been approved that many have seen that was present in some of the earlier phase studies was neuropathy. So that is something to watch out for with momelotinib.
Great. Super insightful. I know this is about novel therapies and JAK2 inhibitors in the space, but super quick comment in the next minute or so about when we sit down as providers with the patient, where does transplant fit in that discussion?
Absolutely. So I had this discussion recently where, I'm not a transplanter myself, but I think a transplanter, if I was a transplanter, I have heard it said by some of my colleagues, their goal is to transplant every patient with myelofibrosis. And I think that's fair in the sense that we know it's the only modality currently that has any ability or any prospect of putting patients into a long-term disease-free remission or perhaps even cure. But why that doesn't really hold up currently, amongst other reasons, first, many of our patients are already in their 70s when they're diagnosed, they have, may have multiple other comorbidities. So they're simply not a suitable candidate for transplant, full stop. And, when you have a younger patient, let's say, with, they may or may not be in the highest risk categories, are you really willing or promoting the path to transplant with the possibility of severe complications when they may live, 10 years or more with this disease? So we have to risk stratify and take those things into consideration, but it certainly is a question that should be considered for any patient when they're diagnosed.
Yeah, I mean, those are the challenges of practicing medicine in this space when you're having this conversation with a disease state that takes so long. Thank you for your comments, Dr. Ode. Next is a case presentation by Dr. Lamar.
The next case is presented by Dr. Lamar.
This is a very, very spry 79-year-old with a long history of polycythemia. She was diagnosed with post-polycythemia myelofibrosis in 2023. She's on ruxolitinib and recently had worsening anemia. Her baseline hemoglobin is around 11.2, but on repeat labs, she dropped to 8.6 and most recently to 7.8. And now there are more options for myelofibrosis patients. And what is your ideal JAK inhibitor in the setting of a ruxolitinib failure? She's 79 and she's very, very opinionated. So I don't know that she'll let me do very much, but there is momelotinib.
All right. What treatment would you think about in a 79-year-old with post-PV myelofibrosis and a hemoglobin of 11 and gets sort of the case we discussed earlier, right? Mm-hmm. So they get put on ruxolitinib and hemoglobin plummets to 8.6 and 7.8.
So, yeah, I think this is, certainly is a case where an obvious choice would be to consider switching to momelotinib. The patient has now become significantly anemic. They're going to start requiring transfusions. And you would hope that momelotinib would have some ability to improve that anemia. It's, I think that's, sort of one lesson that I learned personally shortly after the approval of momelotinib is that though certainly a subset of patients will have some degree of anemia of improvement, it's not every patient. And our expectations maybe were a little bit unrealistic when we first started using momelotinib. So, we have to recognize that we might see some improvement, but it's not necessarily going to go back up to 11.2. So the other, I think, important point about this is, we need to think about, and I don't know if it was delineated in this particular case, what the status of the other features is, so the spleen and the symptoms, and whether those are going to be adequately treated with if we switch to momelotinib. Are we getting a maximal benefit in that sense from the ruxolitinib? And then, increasingly, would we think about whether we want to pursue something else added to the ruxolitinib? And the most obvious choice there would be luspatercept.
What are your thoughts about novel therapies or strategies in this space? Just sort of highlighting what we may see here.
Absolutely. So this is an area of very intense investigation. And let me just emphasize a couple of points with that, which is that anemia, we know, of course, is detrimental. And we know that for a variety of ways, including that patients don't feel good when they're anemic. The burden of going in for frequent transfusions is non-trivial. And we know that anemia is a very significant negative risk factor. So it shortens survival. It is, with whichever prognostic scoring scheme you use, it's one of the biggest risk factors, both anemia and the need for transfusion. So I think it follows then that obviously we'd like to ameliorate that as best as possible. And with, in particular, the recognition of momelotinib and then pacritinib as having the capacity to reduce hepcidin through ACVR1 targeting, that has been a focus of investigation with other novel therapies essentially pursuing an analogous approach to try to reduce hepcidin, reduce that inflammatory anemia. And these are agents that maybe could be partnered with one or any of the JAK inhibitors. And so it gives, if that kind of strategy were to pan out, you could have even more flexibility with choosing one of the four JAK inhibitors plus another agent.
Perfect. We have some questions from the audience, and I'm going to hang on to those if we can. So you want to hit this data for us?
Yes, absolutely. So the next set of slides are going to cover the two big phase three studies that had their initial readouts at ASH last year. And this is the MANIFEST-2 study with pelabresib, which is a BET inhibitor. And in this study, analogous to the second study that I'll review as well, a similar study design in that both studies were patients were randomized to treatment with either ruxolitinib alone or ruxolitinib plus the study drug, in this case, pelabresib. So that's shown here. All patients receive ruxolitinib, and essentially per the label indication, but with a one step lower dose because of the expectation of potential cytopenias with the combination treatment. But again, they receive ruxolitinib plus placebo or pelabresib. And again, the sort of typical endpoints, spleen volume response, symptom response, et cetera. Now, this is showing the spleen volume responses at week 24, and the patients in the combination arm are shown in the dark blue, and these waterfall plots show each individual vertical line represents a single patient. And the way this is shown is that the monotherapy patients are in the light gray, and then the combination are sort of stacked on top of that. And it's meant to visually demonstrate that there clearly was a superior spleen volume response in the combination arm. That's shown visually, where you see that sort of color difference between the two groups. And then in terms of the numbers, you can see 66% of patients achieve that spleen volume response at week 24 and with the combination versus 35% with ruxolitinib alone, which is more or less in the ballpark of what we would have expected. So almost a doubling of spleen response, and that's really impressive. Now we've wrung our hands quite a bit in the field about what does that mean in sort of in real terms for patients with myelofibrosis. Some patients, if their spleen is already adequately reduced by ruxolitinib, how much does it matter, or do we care, so to speak, about increasing that spleen response? But the bottom line is clearly superior with the combination arm in terms of spleen response. Where it was less impressive was with symptom response. And so here again, visually, you can see that there was not so much of a distinction with the two groups, and the spleen and the symptom response was 46.3% in the ruxolitinib monotherapy arm, 52.3% with the combination arm. So clearly no statistically significant difference, at least in terms of this assessment of symptom response. I think one important point to keep in mind here is that the symptom response was, as we would expect, pretty good with ruxolitinib anyway. So maybe there's a ceiling in terms of that symptom benefit, and it's really going to be diminishing returns to try to achieve something higher than that. And now this has also been looked at in terms of absolute reduction in symptom response, suggesting at least a trend towards a benefit with the combination arm. But when we also look at which patients achieve both spleen and symptom response, the overlapping Venn diagram, as shown on the left, you can see clearly a much higher number, 40% of patients in the combination arm achieve both spleen and symptom response versus only 18.5% in the monotherapy arm. So if you're looking for both of those goals, clearly the combination arm was superior. In terms of adverse events, so again, of course, all the patients receive ruxolitinib. You're going to see some degree of cytopenias. Relatively well-balanced in terms of the adverse events between the two arms. We do see some GI toxicity with pelabresib, and that's I think, indicated here, and is something that can be mitigated with antiemetics and antidiarrheals if needed. So with the study as presented, again, the main conclusions were clearly improved spleen response, some trend towards absolute improvement in symptom response, generally well tolerated in terms of the combination treatment, and remains an ongoing question as to is this degree of benefit enough, so to speak, to say that this is a combination therapy that could be considered if it were approved. But longer-term follow-up is ongoing from the study, and we'll see if this drug ultimately gets approved. Now, in a very analogous fashion, the TRANSFORM-1 study with navitoclax was reported out at ASH last year. Again, patients were randomized to either ruxolitinib alone or ruxolitinib plus navitoclax. Navitoclax is a BCL-XL and BCL-2 inhibitor, similar but different than venetoclax. And preclinical studies had supported the rationale that targeting these apoptosis pathways could specifically have benefit in the myelofibrosis setting. So as I mentioned, this was very analogous to the MANIFEST-2 study in terms of the study design. And in terms of tolerability and treatment discontinuation, the treatment discontinuation rate was pretty similar across the two arms. I'll get a little bit further into the specific AEs in just a minute. But in terms of the responses, so this was also pretty similar to the MANIFEST-2 study, clearly superior spleen volume response, 63.2% in the combination arm, 31.5% with ruxolitinib alone. And I don't know if we have it on the next slide or not, but symptoms was clearly not superior with the combination arm. So some pretty similar to MANIFEST-2, but I think even arguing for a trend was not the case in this particular study. The other, I think, important point with navitoclax is it does cause thrombocytopenia. So you can see here, for instance, in the combination arm, 51% grade 3 thrombocytopenia. This is manageable, I think, is maybe fair to say, with temporary dose holds or dose reductions, but it is a component of the drug that I think is would be a real factor with how this could be administered in practice. Okay, so here's the symptom responses. So clearly not different between the two groups. Again, maybe there is a bit of a ceiling in terms of what you can expect with ruxolitinib alone. And so this question remains in the field as to, is this really an appropriate endpoint for this kind of treatment strategy? Okay, so I think the conclusions I've already reviewed, and we'll see where this goes going forward.
Can you get us a day where we reduce the spleen size and the platelets go up like they're supposed to?
Yeah, we always talk about that, right?
Whether tell the patients that, but it never happens, right?
I think that's true. I mean, we talk about it with a JAK inhibitor. We talk about it with splenectomy. Is that really going to lead to both the hemoglobin and the platelets, you know, jumping up? And it really doesn't happen most of the time. And so it's more of a concept, but not a reality.
You want to push forward with other mechanisms here?
Absolutely. So some of the other novel agents under investigation. So one promising agent is selinexor. This is a XPO1 inhibitor. Some of you may be familiar with this drug more so in the multiple myeloma setting and where it is FDA approved. In the myelofibrosis setting, preclinical data supports that it could have activity, and the early data from this this drug in myelofibrosis is encouraging. And this is just one of a few early phase studies supporting that. So here in patients treated with selinexor 60 milligrams once weekly plus ruxolitinib, you can see actually quite impressive responses. Small numbers of patients, but the vast majority of patients achieving that spleen volume, SVR35 spleen volume response. So that certainly supports moving forward with this drug into the next phase of studies. And that is exactly what's happening. So this SENTRY study is a phase 3 study of combination selinexor plus ruxolitinib. Once again, quite analogous to the MANIFEST-2 and TRANSFORM-1 studies. So patients receive ruxolitinib plus or minus selinexor. This is a dosing regimen with selinexor, which is a little bit less so than what's used in myeloma. So the hope is that it will be a little bit better tolerated from that standpoint. Okay, and then finally, imetelstat. So this is a telomerase inhibitor, which has been around for quite a long time. And the phase 2 EMBARK study, which was initiated a number of years ago, what was interesting about this study was that there were two dosing arms, so 9.4 and 4.7 milligrams per kilogram. And it, in just comparing between the two dosing arms, the 9.4 milligram per kilogram arm had superior outcomes and superior survival. So it suggested that not only was this the dose that would be ideal to use, but perhaps this could suggest that this is a drug that could provide that more meaningful long-term benefit in terms of overall survival. And for that reason, the ongoing phase 3 IMPACT MF study is, for the first time in this disease entity, using overall survival as the primary endpoint. So, if that pans out, of course, it will be a big advancement for the field. That, with that in mind, however, this study will take years to complete to be able to assess that. Would you like me?
Perfect.
To
yeah, I'm gonna. Before you jump into case, I have a couple of questions. Can you pontificate on what telomerase mechanism of action versus, XPO versus BET? Like, how do you read those tea leaves from a mechanism of action? This should be how, I mean, obviously we're going to be held to the data when the trials are done, but yep. From a sequencing, hey, I think this is where we're headed.
Absolutely. So with pelabresib and BET inhibition, this is a drug that acts sort of broadly speaking through epigenetic mechanisms, but it is from that standpoint thought to have a role as an anti-inflammatory agent. We know ruxolitinib and the other JAK inhibitors have some capacity to reduce inflammation on their own, but the notion is that it provides additional benefit in that regard. There's cytokine analysis, which is we didn't show here, but baked into the MANIFEST-2 study to support that it does have a potent anti-inflammatory effect. So that's pelabresib. With selinexor, the mechanism by which it might benefit in myelofibrosis is not entirely delineated, but there may be some connection to P53 and JAK-STAT-related signaling pathways. Imetelstat as a telomerase inhibitor is certainly very different, and that also, I think, fair to say, we don't totally understand, but I think the notion is that it may be, by targeting telomerase, capable of specifically targeting the malignant stem cells, and that might be the mechanism by which it could lead to prolonged survival.
Yeah, you have all these different drugs, like trying to find a home. And so we had a question from the audience that basically said, you know, how do we clinically make a decision? Actually, numerous questions, similar case. Like when you're trying to decide between, you know, I think we addressed this earlier to some degree, but from a MDS, MPN, hypoproliferative versus a true myelofibrosis with respect to the specific therapies. And then I got a few real specific questions for you.
Yeah, so you know, just broadly speaking, I think it's
like, when do you pull out the HMA? You know, you got some possible BCL2 on either side, but like, when do you pull the HMA relative to you know, the JAK2?
That is a tough question. So in general, in terms of thinking about HMA, azacitidine, decitabine, that kind of thing, I would view that as really reserved for patients primarily in accelerator or blast phase. And, you know, of course, those patients are very difficult to treat if they're not transplant candidates. They may be frail, and even a low-intensity chemotherapy may be difficult to tolerate. But that is where primarily I would use it. There are isolated cases where the blast percentage may not be increased at least above 5%, but I might consider an HMA if they're extremely hyperproliferative, hyperleukocytosis, and you need a little bit more sort of robust cytoreduction in that sense. But it gets very difficult because, yes, you can bring that, say, white blood cell count of 200,000 down, but you're probably going to be dealing with very severe cytopenias on the other side.
Right. You could get the white count platelet down, but at the expense of the hemoglobin. And that was actually one of the questions, like, how do you navigate those waters where, you know, particularly like a CMML person, sometimes you're forced to kind of pull out an HMA to get the counts down, but then, you know, they're transfusion dependent now. And how do you layer in the JAK with that?
It's very challenging, but I think that is where, now that we have these four JAK inhibitors, in particular momelotinib, pacritinib, it gives us a little bit more leeway to navigate with those patients with the more severe cytopenia. So that is increasingly where I would favor those agents.
All right. Specifically, let's say you've got, a myelofibrosis patient, been on ruxolitinib, cytopenias develop, platelets low, put them on pacritinib, platelets are less than 20,000. Like, where do we go from there?
Honestly, it's extremely tough. I don't know that there's really much else that we can go. We're kind of stuck in those patients. There has been, I think, a little bit of question in the field as to say, why are we not more aggressive with this, in the setting of the cytopenias? Why do we not just say, give platelet transfusions and continue if we think there's a treatment that's effective? But it is very, very challenging in that setting. And if the platelets are that low, that is essentially where I would go, is to pacritinib.
I think that's a space we get into in practice. You see the same in MDS, and the question is always, do I treat through this, right, and hope for better days to come?
Yeah.
At least in the MDS space, right, we can remarrow, and if you're totally, hypoplastic, it gives you some direction to wait and hold.
Yeah.
This case, it's a little trickier, right, because you're going to have persistent fibrosis throughout. Any comments and guidance you can give us on, duration of hold, waiting count recovery? Does it vary by JAK inhibitor? Then tied to that is what happens to, you know, cytokine release with dose interruption. Is that applied to the other JAK inhibitors like it does to ruxolitinib?
Yeah. These are great questions. So the last one I'll tackle first. So the withdrawal type of syndrome, what it tends to be more prominent with ruxolitinib. So there is where I'm much more careful about abrupt discontinuation or titrating off. It, you know, if the patient's already on a low dose of, say, 5 milligrams BID, it's not really so much of an issue. But if they're coming from a higher dose, 15 or 20, that's where I can see that as being more problematic. The other thing I would say is when we think about these cytopenias with a patient who may have been on ruxolitinib or another JAK inhibitor for an extended period of time, and the notion that if we hold the drug temporarily, the counts are going to rebound, there's certainly experience where that can occur. But I think if anything, that maybe is less likely in reality than it really is, meaning that the bone marrow is, you know, in those kinds of patients, it is severely compromised. And so if a patient has been on treatment with ruxolitinib for, let's say, 2 or more years or something, and you're seeing those counts trickle down, you say, okay, I'm going to peel off the drug and hope the counts come up. They're not really in most cases because the disease is more advanced and you're just not going to see that rebound.
Perfect. You want to go through your case vignette for us?
Absolutely. So this is a 67-year-old man who presents with progressive fatigue, night sweats, early satiety, and weight loss of about 15 pounds over the past 3 months. You can see his counts there, white blood cell count 18.2, hemoglobin 9.3, platelets 113, 1% circulating blasts. His spleen is palpable about 11 centimeters below the costal margin. It is causing some early satiety. And you can see his bone marrow shows the characteristic features of myelofibrosis, including grade 2 reticulin fibrosis. Normal karyotype, JAK2 mutation positive, and on a myeloid NGS panel, he has additionally an ASXL1 high-risk mutation. Yeah, DIPSS plus is one of the prognostic calculators that can be used, and by that calculator, he comes into the intermediate 2 risk category, which would be associated with a median survival of about 3 years. And the MIPS 70 plus version 2.0, which does incorporate high-risk mutations such as ASXL1, and does put the patient into a high-risk category, but the number is actually pretty similar in terms of median survival, 3.5 years. Now, should I keep going in terms of treatment?
What do you think you want to do with this guy?
Yeah, so you know, I've seen many patients just like this, but this is kind of intentionally, I put these specific characteristics so it wouldn't be that logical or straightforward, I guess is the best way to say it, because you've got a lot of competing issues here, right? You have a patient who clearly has constitutional symptoms, has symptomatic splenomegaly, so you want to treat that, right? And so from that standpoint, I think the obvious is to say, let's use ruxolitinib. You've got counts that can withstand that for the initial treatment. Hemoglobin, I think it was 9.3, platelet count was in the low 100s. So sure, that makes sense. But what's inevitably going to happen here is the counts are going to drop. And the platelet count's probably going to go below 100,000. And then you're going to ask yourself, do I continue the ruxolitinib or do I need to think about switching and when? And that's where I think the conundrum is.
That's where it gets tough. Speaking of platelet count, Dr. Boucher has a question, case, with respect to the ET situation or the ET disease state here.
Dr. Boucher has several questions about the management of MPNs.
For a patient with essential thrombocythemia and thrombocytosis, at what point do you begin cytoreductive therapy based on the platelet count? What is the risk of thrombosis in that patient? Is the patient with polycythemia vera and has a controlled hematocrit but has thrombocytosis at the same or more risk than the ET patient with the same thrombocytotic level? What is the relative risk of having a patient with a hematocrit between 45 and 50% and not being well controlled? How do you categorize, quote, high-risk patients, and when do you start cytoreductive therapy? And should the upper threshold of the hematocrit be different for women as it is for men? Should it be 45%? Keeping a patient below 45% be the same for women as men, or should they have a lower level? Should it be 42%? Should it be 40%? Or does it matter?
So great questions from Ralph, but I think, you know, really how do we risk stratify these patients based on JAK status, et cetera, age, I think factors in, and
yep,
you know, prior thrombotic event. But Take it.
So I think there were at least 9 really good questions there.
You beat Mulheron, right?
I'll try to keep it concise. So you know, hopefully I can address most, if not all, these with you know, keeping it again concise. So in terms of risk stratification, specifically with an ET, you know, classically we use simply age and prior history of thrombosis as the two determining factors. The IPSET thrombosis incorporates JAK2 status as well, and I think that's, you know, increasingly been recognized that patients with JAK2 mutation with NET are at higher risk, so that can be factored in for sure. And those, you know, sort of correspondingly, who have CALR mutation are at lower risk. And so that is where it gets tricky because, if anything, I often see patients with CALR mutant ET who have very high platelet counts. And so, you know, you're kind of deliberating, do I need to or should I start cytoreductive therapy because these patients have a very high platelet count? And that threshold, some define as 1.5 million, some use a little lower, some use higher. But if anything, in those patients, often what I'm more moved by in terms of that question is, are they having excessive bleeding? And so if they're having unusual bleeding, their platelets are 1.6 million, I might start hydroxyurea or another cytoreductive agent, even if they're CALR mutant and we think their risk of thrombosis is relatively low. So that's kind of a relatively short answer to that. But, you know, just to quickly hit on some of the other points, with regard to the hematocrit target in PV, the CYTO-PV study established that the hematocrit less than 45 is the goal, and that letting it go higher is clearly going to result in higher risk of complications. So that is my standard approach, hematocrit less than 45. The notion between men and women as to whether we should be more specific, that is not something that I incorporate as a standard approach. Just simply keep that hematocrit below 45.
Right. It's based on that point of inflection in the viscosity curve and mm-hmm. should be gender neutral, right? Well, thank you so much. See you guys back. We're going to talk about GYN malignancies.